Pull up a chair. I want to take you to Dayton, Ohio, the National Museum of the United States Air Force. You walk into the Research and Development Gallery, and there's this hush that comes over people, because sitting in front of you is an airplane that does not look like it belongs to this planet, let alone to 1964. It's white, long as a football field, near enough. A needle nose that seems to go on forever, and a tail arrangement, twin rudders way up high, that makes you tilt your head, and when you get down under the belly and look up at the back end, you count the exhausts. Six of them, six engines all bunched together in a box under the tail. This is Radio Hangar, I'm Tail Dragger, and this is the hangar. Today we're going to talk about the North American XB-70 Valkyrie, the fastest, strangest, most beautiful mistake the United States ever built. And the one that's left is sitting right there in Ohio, where you can walk up and touch the rope in front of it. Now, before we get rolling, let me tell you today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight, first solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. And friend, if you know anybody who worked a flight test program, you know they've got a drawer full of stories worth a coin. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. All right, let me set the scene. Back in the 1950s, the whole game was altitude and speed. The bomber pilot's job was simple and terrifying. Fly high, fly fast, get over the target before anybody can climb up and shoot you down. The B-52 was the workhorse, but the Air Force wanted something that would make the Soviet air defenses irrelevant. They wanted a bomber that could cruise at 70,000 feet, not climb to it, cruise there, and do it at three times the speed of sound. Think about that for a second. Mach 3, 2,000 miles an hour, give or take, a bomber the size of an airliner, hauling a nuclear payload, sustained for hours, at a speed where the air itself starts to fight you. North American Aviation won that contract. Same company that gave us the P-51 Mustang, the F-86 Sabre, and the X-15 rocket plane. These were not people who scared easy, and what they came up with still stops your heart in a museum 60 years later. Now here's where it gets interesting. When you fly at Mach 3, you've got a problem. The air piles up in front of you and forms a shockwave. And that shockwave is wasted energy, it's drag, it's the airplane beating its head against a wall. The North American engineers figured out something clever. They called it compression lift. The idea was, instead of fighting that shockwave, you ride it. You shape the underside of the airplane, and you droop the wingtips down, hinge them, fold them down as much as 65 degrees in flight. So the airplane traps its own shockwave underneath itself, like a surfer sitting on his own wave. That trapped pressure gives you free lift. The airplane surfs on the very thing that's trying to slow it down. I want you to picture those wingtips folding down in flight. Each panel bigger than the whole wing on a fighter. Hydraulically hinged, dropping down at speed so the airplane can ride its own thunder. Nobody had done that. Nobody has really done it since. And the skin. You can't build a Mach 3 airplane out of ordinary aluminum, because at that speed friction with the air heats the skin up to 200-300 degrees and beyond. Aluminum goes soft, so they built most of her out of stainless steel. In a honeycomb sandwich braised together. That was brand new, cutting-edge metalwork. And honestly, half the program was just learning how to make the steel hold together. Panels would come out of the oven not bonded right. They had to invent the manufacturing as they went. She fed six General Electric engines, UIJ-93, they were called, each one putting out around 30,000 pounds of thrust in afterburner. All six lined up in a box, breathing through a great rectangular intake under the fuselage with ramps and doors inside that had to slow the incoming air down from supersonic to subsonic before it ever hit the engine face, or the engines would choke. That intake was a machine unto itself. And to feed all that, she burned a special fuel. There was even talk in the early days of an exotic high-energy boron fuel, the stuff they called zip fuel, that was so nasty and so toxic they eventually gave up on it. So she flew on a special jet fuel blend instead, and she drank it by the ton. The first one rolled out in May of 1964, Air Vehicle Number 1. She flew that September, and right away they found the troubles. On that first flight, one of the main gear didn't want to come down right. On later flights, they'd lose pieces of the honeycomb skin off the wings at speed. It took until October of 1965 before Air Vehicle 1 finally hit Mach 3, and even then she could only hold it a few minutes before the heat started peeling her apart. But then they built the second one, Air Vehicle Number 2, and they'd learned they put more of a droop into the wing, they fixed the geometry, and Number 2 could actually hold Mach 3. In May of 1966, she cruised at Mach 3 for half an hour straight, at 72,000 feet. That's the airplane doing exactly what the dream said it would do. For 32 minutes over the American desert, the future was real. Now let me tell you why you've probably never heard her name. The world changed underneath her. While North America was bending stainless steel, the Soviets were building surface-to-air missiles, and a missile does not care how high you are or how fast you're going. In 1960, they'd knocked a U-2 spy plane out of the sky at 70,000 feet. Altitude was no longer a shield, it was a target you'd painted on your own belly.
So the whole reason for the Valkyrie, fly high and fast and untouchable, evaporated. The Air Force and the strategists decided the future bomber would go the other way entirely, down low, under the radar. In the weeds, the B-70 went from being the answer to being an airplane looking for a question. They killed the bomber program in 1961. The two aircraft they'd already committed to got finished and handed over to research, pure flying laboratories now. NASA and the Air Force flew them to learn about supersonic transport, about that big supersonic airliner everybody thought was coming. The XB-70 became the closest thing America ever had to a full-size supersonic airliner test bed, and that brings us to the 8th of June 1966. I need to slow down here because this is the part that hurts. General Electric, the engine maker, wanted a photograph, a publicity formation. Get a bunch of airplanes all flying GE engines together, tuck them in tight on the wing of the beautiful white Valkyrie, and take a picture for the ages. Air vehicle number 2, the good one, the one that could do Mach 3 up in front, and tucked in around her, an F-4 Phantom, an F-5, a T-38, and off her right wing, an F-104 Starfighter. That Starfighter was flown by Joe Walker, and Joe Walker was not some kid. He was NASA's chief test pilot. He'd flown the X-15 to the edge of space. He'd been to over 300,000 feet, one of the finest aviators this country ever produced. They got the photograph. Beautiful shot. Five airplanes in tight formation over the Mojave, the big white bomber and her little chicks all around her. And then something went wrong. The F-104 had these little stubby wings and a big slab tail, and it sat right off the Valkyrie's right wingtip. The theory, and it's still a theory, is that Walker's Starfighter got caught in the wingtip vortex. That invisible tornado spinning off the end of that huge, drooped wing. It rolled him right into the Valkyrie. The Starfighter came up and over, sheared off both of the Valkyrie's vertical tails, and exploded. Joe Walker was killed instantly. And the Valkyrie, the airplane that could ride her own shockwave to the edge of the sky, flew on for a few seconds with no tails at all. Straight and level, almost like she didn't know yet. Then she yawed, and she went into a flat spin, and she came down into the desert. Two men aboard, Al White, the North American test pilot, got out. He rode that escape capsule down and it hurt him bad, but he lived. His co-pilot, Carl Cross, an Air Force major, it was his first flight in the airplane. He never got out, he rode her down. Two lives and the best of the two Valkyries gone in a handful of seconds, for a photograph. Now here's the thing about that day that eats at old pilots like me. Everything about that formation was avoidable. There was no test point being flown, no data being gathered, nothing was learned that day, that had to be learned. It was a picture, and it cost two men and an irreplaceable airplane. If you ever want to understand why we get so serious about formation discipline, about who's responsible for separation, about the difference between a mission and a stunt, you study June 8, 1966. There's a lesson in it that never gets old, so that left one air, vehicle number one. The first one, the one that could never quite hold Mach 3, the one with the flatter wing and all the early troubles, she kept flying research missions for two more years. Then in February of 1969, they flew her one last time. They flew her from California to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio to the museum, and she has not moved since. Now let me put you back in that gallery in Dayton because I want you to understand what you're actually looking at. You're looking at the only one left, not one of a fleet, not a representative example, the last of a species that numbered exactly two, everything the American aerospace industry knew or thought it knew about flying a giant airplane at three times the speed of sound is wrapped up in that white steel skin. Stand under the nose and look down the length of her. 90-some feet of that forward fuselage before you even get to the wing. Walk back and look up at those folding wingtips, locked now in the up position for the crowd, and try to imagine them drooping down in flight. 65 degrees, at 70,000 feet, in air so thin and so hot it glows. Look at the six engine exhausts clustered under the tail, and imagine all six lit in afterburner. The ground crew said you could feel it in your chest from a mile away, a sound like the sky tearing. And then think about the fact that she's indoors now, climate controlled, roped off. Because after that crash, and after the program died, somebody had the good sense to know that this airplane was too important to ever let rust in a boneyard. So she came inside, out of the weather, and there she'll stay. The Valkyrie never dropped a bomb, never flew a mission that mattered to a war. By every cold accounting, she was a failure. Billions of dollars, two airplanes, and one of them destroyed for a snapshot. But I'll tell you what she was. She was the moment American engineers looked at the hardest problem in flight and said, "We'll build it out of steel we don't know how to make yet, with a wing that folds in the air, riding a shockwave. We're going to trap on purpose, and we'll do it now." Everything we learned about supersonic transport, about high-temperature structures, about big airplanes at extreme speed, a lot of it traces back to those two white ships and the men who flew them. She was too advanced for the mission she was born for, and the mission died before she did. That's not failure. That's just an airplane that arrived at the party right as the music changed. So next time you're anywhere near Dayton, do yourself a favor. Go see her. Stand there in that quiet gallery and give a nod to Joe Walker and Carl Cross while you're at it. Because that airplane cost something, and the men who flew her paid it.
My thanks to the National Museum of the United States Air Force and to NASA's own flight test histories for keeping the record straight on this one. You can always find more of what we do over at RadioHangar.com. That's the Valkyrie, the fastest airplane that never went to war, sitting still now, white and perfect, waiting for you to come look up at her. This is Taildragger. Keep your nose up and your stories close. I'll see you next time.